Why? She lives in it? No.
Okay, I'm gonna start everybody. It's 2:20. Just to remind you, the plan is to talk to give the midterm on chapters 0 through 4. We're just going to be starting chapter 4 today. The midterm will be on 10/29, just before Halloween. We'll do a review on 10/27, the Monday of that week. Any comments or questions on that or other administrative stuff? I'm going to start seeing if I can get this. Once again, the word Gieselrub. And Gieselrub. No. Alright, we're still not finding anything on that word. Oh, a member of the class sent me a link to a really bizarre video. Last time we were talking about how this idea of reduction, where we started off with electrons, and out of electrons there was gates, or there was ones and zeros, bits, and the bits were combined using these logic gates, and the logic gates came together to make more complicated logic gates, which eventually created a CPU. The CPU can run programs in a machine language, but it can also run higher level languages that get converted to the machine language, and then high level libraries that let you do things like making video games or graphics or heart monitors or chat programs, that's all built on top of software libraries that are built on top of all those other levels. And so this example is a video game that's been deployed. It's one of these multiplayer 3D video games in which you control little critters. Does anybody actually know this game? I had not seen it before.
Yeah, it's a Little Big Planet.
Little Big what?
Little Big Planet.
Little Big Planet. All right. So Little Big Planet. In this world, you can create things by sticking them together, and the objects in the world have certain properties. Well, some very enterprising individual stuck together a whole bunch of components in this world and created a calculator that can add numbers, subtract numbers. I'm not sure what else it is, whether it can multiply. But just either add or subtract. And the way that you activate it is by making your little character jump on the buttons and pull the levers. And so it's in the simulated world, but they're acting like switches and buttons and stuff in the real world. And the way that it actually does the calculation is by she glued together a whole bunch of stuff. So here's, this is just part of the interface, but eventually the character starts to, apparently they can fly in addition, here he goes, he's flying now. So he's going over the calculator, and now all the wires are visible. This person in the game plugged together, and you can see all the different components and so forth, that all these wires and components and so forth are actually what's implementing the calculator. It's actually making the calculator out of parts that were available in this world that itself only exists inside a computer, which itself is implemented in terms of all these other levels. So at some point, it's just your head starts to explode, right? Because this computer, presumably, if they had a sophisticated enough computer in this world, it could start to simulate other video games, including maybe Big Little World or Little Big World, in which someone in that game could create a world out of parts that are lying around. So it starts to get really tedious, of course, to create these things, but it's perfectly within this notion of reduction. So So I mentioned reduction last time when I was talking about this, and this is I think a great example, but I'm not sure that I did a good enough job of defining it. So let's do a quicker question. So when I say that reduction is one of the main goals of the science of computation, computer science, what do I mean by reduction? So choice A, does that mean, you know, what we're trying to reduce is the time to market, how fast we can get a computer from the design to being able to sell it in the store. B is reduce the cycle time, that is to say, the amount of time that it takes for the computer to process one machine instruction. The faster that is, the faster the computer runs. So that would be desirable. Is when I talk about reduction, is it C, reducing the size of the circuitry? That is to say, the AND gates and the OR gates and the NOT gates, if you can make, the smaller you can make them, the more computational power you can pack into one device that you could maybe even carry with you. So that seems like a valuable thing. D, reduce the overall cost of production. So you want to make a computer, but you want to make it as cheaply as possible. That's another kind of reduction. And then E, what about reducing complex problems to simpler ones? So this idea that you've got something that's very difficult to solve, if you can only turn it into a version of the same problem, or a simpler version of the problem, and solve it as a simpler version, then you can solve more and more complicated problems. So when I talk about reduction, which of these five choices am I actually talking about? All these things are valuable, and all these things are things that people are trying to do. The question is, when I say this is an example of reduction, which kind of reduction am I talking about? All right, we can almost wrap this up. Anybody else still picking? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. Yeah, that one. Right, and so in the sense in which this example, this little big man, little big horn, big little world, I lost it. What is it? Little big planet. So the sense in which this little big planet is an example of reducing complex problems to simpler ones is that each of these levels, the hardware of the computer, the circuitry, the logic gates, the CPU with the machine language on it, the higher level machine language, each time it's handling more and more complexity, and always the way that complexity is handled is by implementing it in terms of whatever's the next simplest one down. It has to go all the way down to the bottom, but no individual person has to think about that entire chain. You're free to just think about what you're trying to do and how to express it in terms of the level below you. So it's just a really, really powerful idea that lets people create goofy calculators and any other number of other things. All right. The other thing we talked about last time was subroutines and Scratch. So just to make sure that you're kind of getting the flow here about what subroutines look like in Scratch and what they do. A little burpy now from the Coke. Sorry about that. So this is a little Scratch script. So let's say we click on the green flag, and the top script says play sound and wait. Then it says broadcast A and wait. Then it says it again, broadcast A and wait. Then it stops. And the A script, when I receive A, it says play sound and wait, play sound and wait, stop script. So the question is, if I click the green flag, how many pops are we going to hear? 1, A is 1, B is 2, C is 3, D is 4, and E is 5. So let's take a look at this. So here we've got some Scratch going. I've been sprites to click on. I've been choosing this little box here, the Get Surprise Sprite. You just click on this, and from its library of images, it just chooses one, and then you get to give it action. So apparently I got this guy. I had an octopus before and a grasshopper, a dragon, but now I've got this guy. All right, so let's give him that script that we were just looking at. We'll say, we'll make it so when we click on him, what does it do? He said to take, to play the sound pop and wait. So the first thing to do is, what if we, you know what, that's on A. All right, if I click on this subroutine, if I run this subroutine, what will it do? It will pop twice. Okay? There we go. So that's what this A subroutine does. So now this sprite 5, this guy, what does he do? He pops once. Then he broadcasts A, and what's that going to do? It's going to pop twice. Then it broadcasts A again, it's going to pop twice again. So the total number of pops should be 5. So let's just keep trying it out. Okay? So the first pop is coming from this script, the second two are when A is called, and the last two are when A is called the second time. So this one should have been, there you go, all right, good. That was the right choice. Good, that means we can do more sophisticated subroutines. Here's a more sophisticated subroutine. Alright, so this subroutine, it's a face. When we click on the face, it says set n to 0, then it does change n by 1, then it broadcasts feeling and waits, and when that comes back, it says n u for 2 seconds. Here's what feeling does. It says I am feeling for 2 seconds. Then, if n is 0, it says sad for 1 second. If n is 1, it says okay for 1 second. If n is 2, it says great for 1 second. And if n is less than 2, it says could be better for 1 second. Okay? So now the question is, if we get this started, we click on the face, will A say, and you? I am feeling sad. Okay, great, could be better. Choice B is, it'll say, I am feeling okay, and you? Choice C is, I'm feeling could be better. Choice D is, I'm feeling okay, could be better, and you? And choice E is, I am feeling sad, could be better, and you? All right, so I should try to get enough of this on the screen so you can see it all at once. That is the bottom.
Is this when you only click it once?
So we're going to click on the face once, and it starts to talk out of the speech bubble. And the question is, what will its little dialogue be? It is one of these things, so it's... that's basically the sort of thing I'm looking for. There's pauses in between and so forth, but don't worry about that. Yeah, there's got to be a way to get more drums from this. But I'm going to show you the top again. When face click set into 0, change in by 1, broadcast feeling and weight, and then here's the subroutine. Reinforce this idea of subroutines that can have parameters from the outside. So here the idea is that there's this variable n that gets set to 0, and then 1 gets added to it. So now n is 1 when the subroutine feeling gets called. But I think everybody got that part. I don't think that was what was tricky. The tricky thing is once you get in here and n is 1, what happens? So everybody says, okay, it says I am feeling, but then what? Is n 0? No, so it doesn't do this if block. Is n 1? Yes, so it says okay. Is n 2? No, so it doesn't do this if block. Is n less than 2? Yes. So it says could be better. So these ifs do not have to be mutually exclusive because they're grouped one under the other. Each time the if is done, it evaluates the next one in the chain. So in this case, actually two of these if statements ended up firing. And so I can actually show you that. I think I still have it around. Yeah, here we go. All right, so this is actually where I got it from. I call this octopus face. Well, anyway. Alright, so if I click on the octopus, he says, I am feeling okay, could be better. And why is it doing that? Because it's going through this script step by step and doing each of the if statements because they're all glued one after the other. If it was nested inside, if it had an else, that would be different. But it wasn't. It's one if statement, it should do that whole thing and then go to the next step. Do the whole thing, go to the next step. So two of these can execute. So, so this was the right answer. But this is, so the reason I think a lot of people chose this one is because when you saw this if statement hitting, you said, oh, okay, now we're done. And the answer is no, it keeps going through until it gets to the bottom. In this case, it got to do two different statements. All right. Yes?
I had D originally, but I thought it said N equals 2 on the bottom.
You thought this symbol here was equals? Is that what you're thinking?
No, I can barely see it, so I guess.
It is harder. Okay. Oh yeah, yes. Now everybody thought it was equals?
Yeah.
Thanks for being honest. I appreciate that. I absolutely agree that it's much more hard to see up here than it is on my screen. So if we can cut people some slack on that one. But the important thing is not the points. The important thing is do know that these if statements are executed sequentially. All right. So if that had said n equals 1, you'd get both of those executing. All right.
We will cut people slack. It's about the learning. It's not about the punishment this time. All right. So good. So that's all I had for that. I want to point out that last time I didn't follow my own lecture notes, sadly, and I ended up speeding through recursion, which I was supposed to leave to today. So what I'd like to do is just go through some of the recursion stuff to see if there's anything more I wanted to say about it or anything more that you wanted to ask about it. Because I really rushed it, and in fact, I intended to start talking about that today. So that was a planning error on my part. So I'm going to just review the very, very end of Chapter 3, and then we'll go back and start on Chapter 4. All right, so I think I started to speed up around here. This idea of the magical mystery tour with the parameter, I think everybody got that because we just did a parameter example on the quicker questions, and that did not seem to be, 80% of the class didn't seem to have any trouble with that at all. But what I think I didn't do is show you, I didn't get you to let you stare at this for very long. So this is the bottles of beer song. So here we have, when the bottle of beer is clicked, it sets a variable bottles to 99, and then it sings the beer song with that variable set to 99. Here's how the beer song goes. If the number of bottles is more than zero, if there's any bottles left, it will say that number, so 99 bottles of beer on the wall, 99 bottles of beer, one of those bottles that have in a bottle. I'm sure you know other versions of this song. Then it decreases the number of bottles because it's a spell, right? So change bottles by minus one, so now there's 98. It'll say 98 bottles of beer, or 98 bottles of beer on the wall. Then what should it do after that? Well, now it can basically sing the whole song again starting from 98. That's the way that the song plays out. So it broadcasts the same beer song and waits. So it's sort of, you can picture that what's going on here is there's somebody singing the 99 bottles of beer song, and the way that it does that, the way that the beer bottle does that, is it sings about 99, and it says, oh, all the rest of the numbers, I'll just make a copy of myself, and he'll sing the rest from 98 on. And 98, of course, what 98 does is it sings about 98, and it's like, oh, I got to do from 97 down, so it makes a copy of itself. So now there's three bottles of beer singing. Most of them are just waiting for the last guy, but eventually it plays all the way out to 100. What happens when the bottles of beer get really close to the end? Once there's one bottle of beer, it'll say one bottles of beer. That would be above, right? It should be bottle of beer when it's one, but it would make the program a little more complicated. One bottles of beer on the wall, one bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, now bottles gets decremented down to zero. It'll say zero bottles of beer on the wall. Then it'll sing the beer song again. It'll go up to the top and say, oh, bottles is zero now. Zero is not greater than zero. So this if statement will be skipped. It will go to the bottom, and the script will end. And then all these bottles of beer will kind of collapse back up to the top one, who was the one that was originally called, which will return control back up to this, the real beer bottle that started it all, which is now done, so it's over. So it will sing each of those verses in turn and stop, which is the right thing to do. Now, the first time I wrote this program, my kids really like this because, I don't know, it made me look stupid, I guess. Like my kids at home, my actual like biological children, I left out this if statement. What will happen if you leave out this if statement? How will the song go? So it'll be 99 bottles of beer, 98 bottles of beer, da, 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 da. Two bottles of beer on the wall, two bottles of beer, four of those bottles happen to fall, one bottles of beer on the wall, one bottles of beer on the wall, one bottles of beer, four of those bottles happen to fall, zero bottles of beer on the wall, zero bottles of beer on the wall, zero bottles of beer, and now there's no if statement to catch it. So it'll say, if one of those bottles should happen to fall, negative one bottles of beer on the wall, negative one. By the time I caught it, it had actually sung all the way down to negative 273 bottles of beer on the wall. And, yeah, that was sort of silly. So you really need this termination condition, this thing that's going to catch the end of the song and tell it, don't do any more after this, otherwise it will go on forever. And this idea of programs that never stop, even though you want them to, is going to be a big theme when we get into chapter 4, probably beginning next week. All right, so that's the recursive bottles of beer song. But this idea of self-reference, I talked about a little bit. We've got this nice broccoli. And we've got this. This is what happens if you leave off the termination condition. You get songs that never end. We did the recursion song. What was it? And that may be the end of everything. All right, so that may be all I was going to say about that. All right, any other comments or questions? Anything else to say on chapter 3? Chapter 3, once again, was all about programming computers. People trying to put things together to make the computer do what the person wants. And what does the computer have to do to make that possible, and how does the person need to talk to the computer to make that happen? So now we've kind of glued all that together, and we're going on from there. You can ask a question. Was it a silly question? You're embarrassed now.
Can we listen to your song again?
Which one? The recursion song?
Yeah.
I'll think about it at the end of class. I have a tendency to lose people. Once the song happens, people are just like in happy or something, singing zone, and then it's hard to concentrate after that. So I will, I'll cue it up. Here it is. It's queued up, and I'll get back to it. But thanks. I assume that was because you wanted to hear it and not just because it wastes time. Let's say it. All right, so we can watch a film strip. All right, so... All right, so chapter 4. So basically where we are at this point in the book is
we've learned everything there is to know about computers as physical devices, right? We know that a computer can be built out of these parts. We know that people can program them. They can do all sorts of things. They can change lights and displays. They can get inputs from keyboard. We have kind of a complete picture of a computer. What we haven't really talked about is, what can these things actually do? So chapter 4 is about a piece of computer science that maybe isn't so important in the day-to-day use of computers, but it's very, very important on the academic side and the philosophical side, which is, what is computation and what can you really do with it? What are the limits of computation? What is the power of computation? So Hillis calls this chapter How Universal Are Turing Machines, but you know, we don't know what universal means and we don't know what Turing Machines means yet, so we'll have to kind of figure that out as we go. When I first wrote this slide, I guess I was feeling kind of cynical. Maybe that's the right word to use. Because philosophy has often annoyed me in the past. But a lot of times philosophical discussions to me get into this sort of circular thing where they're not really going anywhere, and I don't really care what the answer is at some point, and so it's just a waste of time. But I guess I don't feel quite that bad about it anymore. But nevertheless, this is the way that I said it in the slide. Some fields are actually ignored by philosophers. You know, good for them. Like if you're a civil engineer or a physical chemist, the philosophers don't look over your shoulder and wonder what you're doing. They just don't really seem to care very much. But they care about like quantum physics because that's just weird. They care about cognition in various ways. What is the mind actually doing? And they care about computer science because they want to know answers to questions like, what does it mean to know something? You know, what is intelligence? Can computers be intelligent? What does it mean to compute something? Do planets, as they move around, are they computing their orbits? I mean, they're making these perfect ellipses. Are those computed in some sense? Is that what you mean by computation? They don't seem like computers. They seem like, you know, giant rocks spinning through space. But you can look at them and you can get answers to certain mathematical questions. So are they computers? So they ask these questions, and a lot of times I'm feeling like, I don't care. It doesn't really change what I'm going to do day to day. One of the reasons that I think that philosophers are so interested in this, and Hillis makes this argument in the book, that in some ways it's just the latest of the great humiliations that humankind has had to face and grow through the experience of. So the way that he listed it in the book is, he said, well, Freud said this first. Freud and Hillis, you know, together again. So Freud said that Galileo and his work in astronomy was very disruptive to people, and it really changed the way that people viewed the world because it argued that our world that is so special to us and so absolutely central to our existence is really just another world. There's bodies in space all over the place. There's these planets and stars and comets, and they're all out there. We're just one, just another rock. And that's you can view that as being very disruptive. The Darwin's theory says, well, you know, yes, humans, we're humans, and that's very special to us, but really it's just another species. You know, jellyfish are cool too. And so that can be very disruptive. And Freud said of his own work, he's like, yes, and I'm right there behind Darwin and Galileo. There's me, Freud. And what I'm saying is consciousness is just another mental process, and this is very disruptive. And Hillis said, well, we can go one step further. Turing, who was the first computer scientist before there were actual computers, or just in the beginning when they're actual computers, said, well, maybe we can think of our mind as just another computing device. The thing that makes us us, really, truly, deeply, inside, maybe it's just another computer. And again, I think that philosophers wanted to not just accept that, they wanted to really question it and say, well, what do you mean by that? Does that really change who we are? Do you mean by computation the same thing when you're talking about a machine as you mean about people? And so they look at various ways of teasing these things apart. And so there's this long history of philosophers, you know, meddling with what computer scientists are trying to do. So one example of an argument here by Dan Dennett, he says, how is it that a computer thinking and a person thinking are really not at all the same? He said, it's really easy. How is it different between a real rainstorm raining and a computer simulation of a rainstorm raining? Well, in the computer simulation, no one actually gets wet. So he's arguing, therefore, well, when a computer's thinking, it's not really thinking. It's just pretending, it's simulating thought. And so that's an argument that he made. I don't know that doesn't resonate with me. I don't know how you guys feel about it. Well, I mean, wetness is something in the physical world. If ideas are really these sort of abstract concepts, what does it matter if they came out of an electronic box or they came out of a biological box? Is that really different? Or if they are different, it may not be quite because it's a question of simulation. Dreyfus, one of the Dreyfus brothers, are philosophers that looked at these issues, and they said, well, you know, computers can't translate human languages. And that still remains relatively true, but they're getting very good. And in fact, I don't know, if you clicked in Google and like translate this page, you somehow inadvertently get to a page in Hungarian or something like that. You click on translate this page, and you get something that's sort of vaguely readable, more so than you would have been able to do yourself. So it's a useful translation, even though it doesn't feel like the kind of translation that maybe a person would produce. Lucas said, computers, people can reflect on our own thought processes, and computers can't do that. But it's not really clear why he would say that computers can't do that. If he doesn't really understand how people do it, it may be very well that computers could do it if they were built the right way or programmed the right way. So, I don't find any of these arguments all that really compelling. So what I'd like to do now is kind of take you through what's sometimes called the Church-Turing hypothesis. But to do that, we have to think a little bit mathematically for a moment. So there's been lots of different models of computation that have been proposed. And what I want to try to argue is, or at least describe, what does it mean for one model of computation to be more powerful or less powerful or equally powerful to another one? And so I'm going to do that by telling you about some of the abstract stuff, and then I'll give you a more concrete example with video games. Because it's easier for me to think about there. So one kind of computer that we've talked about is the von Neumann architecture, the idea that you have a memory and you have a CPU, and at each cycle around, it's taking all the information from all the memory locations and the registers, it follows some instruction, it makes some update to its memory, and that all gets fed, and it just goes around and around and around. That architecture was proposed actually by Babbage in the 1800s, but von Neumann is the one who first really got it running on modern electronic computers. And that's the way all computing devices are built today. So that's one model of computation. It's basically a finite state machine with memory. So that's one kind of computer, but it's not the only kind of computer, at least that you can imagine abstractly. Alan Turing, who was responsible for building machines that could actually crack the German codes in World War II, he was also a mathematician and a theorizer of machines, and he proposed a very abstract kind of machine that I don't think people have really built per se, but it was called a Turing machine, and he described how it would work. It basically consisted, again, of a finite state machine, but instead of a memory all laid out with numbers, it had a tape, or you imagine that it had a tape. So basically, it's a long strip of paper, and at any given time, the finite state machine is looking at one square on that tape. And on any given time click, it can erase what's there and fill it in with something else using its finite state logic, and then shift the tape left or right. And what he was able to show is there's certain things that you can compute with a Turing machine, and there's certain things that you can't compute. So that's another. There's also a guy named, a philosopher, a mathematician named Post, who came up with a bunch of rules for just rewriting strings. You have this string, there's a rule that says you can turn it into this other string. And by writing down different sets of rules and applying them to strings, different sorts of things can pop out. And you can interpret them as like multiplying two numbers or taking the square root of numbers. You can look at them as actual computations. Church, another mathematical philosopher person, invented a thing called lambda calculus, which is basically just a way of writing down functions. Like x squared, but a much more sophisticated way of writing down functions that also would allow you to express lots of different kinds of transformations on numbers, which are basically functions or computations. Chomsky is a linguist who's still alive, and he proposed context-free, context-sensitive grammars, which again were kind of string rewrite rules. And then there's the kind of programming languages that we're most familiar with, things with instructions and loops and subroutines, things like Scratch and Python and C and Java. And these are all different ways that you might think about computation. And so the question is any one of them more powerful or less powerful than another? Or are they all really, in some sense, the same? And how can we think about that? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to draw arrows from one kind of machine to another kind of machine if the first machine can simulate the other machine. So, for example, we know, and we talked this through about writing compilers and so forth, that a von Neumann architecture, an actual CPU of a computer, can simulate programming languages, can take a program written in a programming language and bring it to life, actually make it happen. So if you have a von Neumann machine, you can use it to run a program in a programming language. Okay? So that means that in some sense, which one of these is, let's see, just based on this, if one of them is more powerful than the other, which one is the more powerful? Could it be that programming languages are more powerful than von Neumann architectures? And the answer is no, because anything you can write in a programming language can be simulated by a von Neumann architecture. So if one of these is more powerful than the other, it would have to be where the arrow came from, the von Neumann machine. Okay? So this is how we're going to define the power of different models of computation. We're going to say that one model of computation is more powerful than another, or no less powerful, if it can simulate the other one. Okay? So just take it step by step. So that's the first thing. Now we also notice that we can write a program, and in fact that's what I did for making the demo. I can write a program that emulates a von Neumann architecture. So if you have something that can run programs, you can use that to run a von Neumann architecture. So that means that programming languages are no less powerful than von Neumann architectures. But we also know that von Neumann architectures are no less powerful than programming languages. So which one is more powerful? They're the same, right? So if I say, my age is no greater than, I forget how old I am, 42. Yeah, right. My age is no greater than 42, and I can also tell you that 42 is no greater than my age. From those two facts, you could say, well, that means my age is exactly 42. One is bigger than or equal to the other is bigger than or equal to the one, they have to be the same. Okay? So like, x is greater than or equal to 2, x is less than or equal to 2, x has to equal 2. So that's basically what we figured out here, that if a von Neumann architecture can simulate a programming language, and a programming language can simulate a von Neumann architecture, they're the same. Anything you can do in one, you can do in the other. They're equivalent in terms of what they can compute. Okay? So far we said, all right, here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different models. Those two are really the same. Anything you can do with one, you can do with the other. Well, Post showed that, Turing showed that you can take anything that you can do with a Turing machine, you can simulate with Post correspondence rules. Anything you can, so the lambda calculus can simulate a Turing machine. Chomsky context-sensitive grammars can simulate a Turing machine. A von Neumann architecture can simulate a Turing machine. So at the moment, who looks like the most powerful model? The powerful one is the one that can do the simulation, right? So programming languages can simulate von Neumann, which can simulate Turing machine. So the weakest model seems to be the Turing machine, right? Because everybody can simulate that. Like, everybody can speak English. It must be the easiest language. No, this is, so everyone, all the different things, all the different models can all slum it with Turing machines. So therefore, the Turing machine must be sort of the lowest level. But then, Turing showed that actually, a Turing machine can simulate a von Neumann machine slowly, very slowly. It has to write all the memory things on its tape, and it has to spool the tape, and it takes a very long time. But anything you can do with a von Neumann architecture, and therefore a modern programming language, you can also do with a Turing machine, as simple as they are. So they're equal. And in fact, programming languages can simulate all these other models. So really, a Turing machine can simulate programming languages, and programming languages can simulate everything else. They're all the same. All these different models that people have proposed over the last 100 or so years, they're all interchangeable with one another. None of them can compute something that the others can't. They're all equally powerful. So that's actually kind of exciting and surprising, and has led people to wonder, maybe there just isn't any other kind of programming paradigm. Maybe the computation really is this one thing that you can dress up in different costumes, but it doesn't fundamentally change what it is. And that's essentially, that's the weak form of the Church-Turing hypothesis. The Church-Turing hypothesis basically says, anything you can do with one sufficiently powerful programming paradigm, or computation paradigm, you can do with all of them. All right, so if that was a little too abstract, let me give you something that's a bit more concrete. So let's pretend that, I'm really desperate to play Mario. In fact, this was a bit after my time. I'm more interested in playing Atari games from the 80s. But nevertheless, there are people who grew up playing these Mario games. And if you really want to play one now, it's not so easy to do. How can you play this game? Well, to play this game, you kind of need a Nintendo... I don't even know what it's actually called. Nintendo... It's not GS. What is it?
Nintendo Entertainment System.
Oh, NES? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
No, what did you say? Nintendo. No, there's lots of Nintendo the company. They had particular game systems. So NES is
right. Yes.
All right. So, all right, I'll take it as a Nintendo NES. So if I had a Nintendo NES, I know that because of the machinery in that box and the software that I can load into it, I can play the Mario game. All right, great. So what does that mean? That means that Nintendo NES device can simulate the Mario world. But I don't have one of those. However, it turns out that there's this thing called a Dell, which is a kind of computer. It's not the kind that I have, but it is a kind of computer. And there is a program called Nestopia, where the NES is the NES that we're talking about. It's a program that runs on the Dell, but makes the Dell act like the Nintendo NES. So that means if I had a Dell and these software that I could do the mapping with, it must be at least as powerful as Mario World, because I can simulate the NES and I can use the NES to run the Mario World. So there's this sort of chain of simulations that I can do. But I don't have a Dell, I have a Mac. But it turns out that there's a thing called iEmulator, which is a piece of software that runs on the Mac that, guess what it does? It simulates a PC. It allows the Mac to act and run the same software that runs on the Dell. So wrap your head around this. If I just had a Mac and the right software, I could use the Mac to pretend it's a Dell, and that Dell can be running a program, that simulated Dell can run a program that makes it a simulated NES, and that simulated NES could be running the Mario program in it. So now all of a sudden this Mario thing is running on my Mac, several levels of simulation removed. But if it's fast enough, you don't know the difference. That wants to be a question? Yeah.
Well, Nestopia actually works on like any computer.
Yeah, but the example is more interesting if we just let it run on the Dell. No, I understand. I understand. Yeah, so there's another way. So what would that look like? So there's a version of Nestopia for the Dell, but there's also a version of Nestopia for the Mac. So how could I change this picture? Right? I could have an arrow coming out of the Mac that says Nestopia pointing at the NES, right. So my Mac could directly emulate the NES. And in fact, there's probably ports, there's probably versions of Mario World that have been rewritten so that they run directly on the Mac. So then I could actually make an arrow directly to Mario World from my Mac. But nevertheless, this idea of using one computational device to pretend to be some other one so that it has all the capabilities that other one has is this very powerful idea, and it's sort of practical. But it's very useful mathematics. All right, so the Church-Turing thesis is usually taken to mean that any machine computation can be carried out on a Turing machine. They're all the same as Turing machines. But sometimes it's actually expanded. This is what Hillis says in the chapter. If you haven't read chapter 4 yet, this would be something that you should put on your to-do list. That you can expand this thesis to say that actually any physical system, anything that you can do in the real world, you can do with a Turing machine. And by extension, since brains are in the real world, that would imply that our brains are equivalent to Turing machines. Right? We can use our brains to simulate a Turing machine, we can use a Turing machine to simulate any physical system, and any physical system can simulate a computer, and a computer can simulate a Turing machine. Therefore, brains and Turing machines can do the same kinds of computation. So, again, this is more a philosophical point than anything else, but it's one that's worth chewing on. What does that really mean about who we are, what we can do, and what computers are and what they can do? So that's the first little chunk of chapter 4. Any questions or comments on that? We're gonna build on it in various ways, but I'm not going to get into the details of that again. This main thing I wanted to get across was this idea of simulation is a way to tell which thing is more powerful than another. You know, does anybody watch Heroes, the TV show? Not everybody. All right. So in Heroes, different characters in Heroes have different superpowers. Some of which are physically plausible and some of which are not physically plausible, but the show doesn't want you to care about that. They just notion of powers. But there's one guy whose superpower basically says he can emulate anybody else's superpower. Right? You know. Hang on a second. Anybody else? There were more hands. You watch it not enough to know who's got what superpower. So the characters have superpowers, and one of the characters' superpowers is basically the ability to emulate other people's superpowers. So Peter, did you both say Peter? Yeah, okay. And then Siler can sort of do it, but it involves a certain amount of bloodshed. It's not really clear what he's doing there.
But the point is that in some sense, Peter is more powerful, or at least as powerful as any other of the superheroes, right? Because anything they can do, he can also do. And that's really the key idea that's being used a lot in this notion of understanding the relationship between models of computation. If one can do everything that another can do, it can't be any less powerful. And if they can each do what the other one does, then they have to be equally powerful.
And of course, in a recent show, they had Peter take Siler's power, and I don't know, if Siler took Peter's power, and I don't, it's all way too hard to make sense. All right, so that was the end of that section. So the next thing to talk about is, it turns out that a lot of computer science research has gone into understanding the powers and limits and philosophies of flipping coins. Like, what can you do with a coin flip that you can or cannot do with other models of computation that don't have coin flips? So we'll talk about ways of designing algorithms, designing solutions to problems that use coin flips to actually make things go faster. But for now, let's talk a little bit about some probability theory, because we're going to find that useful. So you may know some of this stuff already, but I want to reinforce the pieces that I'm actually going to use. All right, so let's imagine. So since numbers are made of bits, we can generate a random number using random bits. So we're going to again use this idea of reduction, that any random thing we want to do is going to eventually reduce down to just generating random bits. So if there's a way to create random bits, so let's pretend that we've got a statement in our computer language that anytime we ask it, hey, can you flip a coin for me, it'll come back with either heads or tails with equal probability and no predictable patterns, completely random. So let's pretend that we have something like that. How can we use that to make something that would pick a random number between 0 and 3? So that's kind of like, if you think a coin flip is 0 or 1, heads are zeros, tails are ones, something like a dreidel, which has four sides, how would you get something that would randomly choose from those four sides with equal probability on all four of those sides? The only thing that you've got at your disposal is the ability to flip a single coin. You can flip it multiple times, but that's all you can do. You can just flip coins. So how do we turn that into to choosing a random side of a dreidel? Or if you don't like dreidels for whatever reason, Twister, I think, you have four colors, like red, blue, green, and green again. Yellow? Okay, all right. So again, sometimes you need a device that will give you a random choice, equal probabilities on four choices. So how do we do that? So our choices are 0, 1, 2, and 3. How do we write a little program that will choose one of these for us with equal probability? I wish I had a coin. I don't think I actually have a coin.
I can flip a cell phone.
Alright. So
how can we do that? How do we choose a random number 0, 1, 2, or 3?
I mean, imagine you're playing Twister and you lost the little spinner thing and all you've got in your hand is a coin and you want to play the game fairly. How would you use that coin to continue to play Twister? I'd use the coin to go to the store and buy a spinner. No. No. Oh, now I have a coin. Thank you. I'll give you that. All right, so I can go heads or tails now, but I'm trying to go 0, 1, 2, or 3. How do I use the coin? Think, people, think. Or talk. If you've already done thinking, you're just being quiet. Yes?
Like, you could flip the coin once for each number and say if it's heads, then stop here. If it's tails, move to the next one and flip again.
All right. So let's think that through. So what's going to happen? So we'll think about the different options of the coin flip as kind of branches of a tree. So we start off, we flip the coin, and it's either going to come up heads or tails. Those are the two possibilities. So you're saying if it comes up heads, then the number we chose is 0?
Right.
Okay. If it comes up tails, then we flip the coin again.
Right.
All right. This is good. So now we flip the coin again, and again, it comes up either heads or tails. If it comes up heads, we'll say that we just chose a 1. If it comes up tails, we'll flip the coin again. And again, it will come up either heads or tails. If it comes up heads, we'll say the answer was 2. And if it comes up tails, we'll say the answer was 3. Or do we keep going?
You shouldn't really do either.
What's that?
If you're only doing 4, then you could...
Yeah, we're only choosing 0, 1, 2, or 3, and we want them with equal probability. So we'll say if it comes up tails, we'll choose 3. All right, so this will choose randomly, 0, 1, 2, or 3. In fact, we'll do it right now. All right, tails. So it tells us to flip a coin again. Tails tells us to flip a coin again. Tails. All right, we chose the number 3. Okay? Yes?
actuality that flip a coin number 50% of the kids is heavier. So almost the time.
All right, so the claim is that physical coins are not actually 50% heads, 50% tails. It's actually 49.999999% tails and 50.001% heads. We're going to ignore it, even if that's true, and I'm not sure it's true, but let's just pretend it's not. I mean, let's just pretend that it's 50-50. Have they done these studies? There's like a little coin flipping machine that's just all day long. All right. Yes.
With that model, though, isn't it less likely that it'll be two or three?
Ah, so this will produce 0, 1, 2, or 3, which we wanted. But what are the probabilities of these three choices? What's the probability that it'll choose 3? It could be 1 in 4, but it's not. Right? The only way that it'll come up 3 is if you flip tails, 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 which is 1 in 8. So this comes up 1 in 8. 2 comes up 1 in 8. 1 comes up, how often? You know? 1 in 4. And 0 comes up 1 in 2. A half plus a quarter plus an eighth is 1. So that's the full range of probabilities, but they're not evenly distributed over the four choices. So, yes, we chose at random, but we didn't choose at random in an unbiased way. So, in fact, it's going to come up 0 very, very often. Yes?
When you flip it the first time, heads could be 0 or 1,
and
tails could be 2 or 3.
So maybe we can sort of balance things out a bit. Is that where you're going?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so let's see how we can do that. Great. All right, so now you're saying we flip a coin. There we go. We flip a coin, and it comes up either heads or tails. So now what are you saying to do next?
Heads, you'll flip for 0 or 1. If it's tails, you'll flip for 2 or 3.
So we flip again. We flip a second time? Yeah, all right. So now we're going to flip the coin again. And if it comes up heads twice,
it'll be 0.
Then we'll call that 0. If it comes up tails the second time,
it'll be 1.
If it came up tails the first time, again, we're going to flip a second coin. And if it came up tails heads,
2.
2. And tails tails, 0.
3.
Not 3. Yeah. All right, so again, we're randomly choosing, all the choices are possible. The probabilities now are all a quarter. So they're all equally likely now. So that's that. The first idea was a good idea. This idea is an improved idea because it actually gets us our uniform distribution over the set of choices. Interesting. Very good. Any comments or questions on that? That worked out great. You never can tell with these, you know, the interactions with the class. Either people won't get it at all, or they'll get it too quickly. This way, I think you got to see the thought process, and I think that was, let's just say that was helpful. All right, good. All right, so we're good? All right, so here's another way to think about the same thing. Let's say that heads are 0 and tails are 1. I'm going to flip the coin twice and write down what I get. Tails. It's only coming up tails. I'm wondering about this coin. You want to check it? See, I could totally get sued for something like that. I don't know why. I'm really sorry that it hit you in the back. I'm sorry that it almost hit you in the eye. And I'm sorry you had to stretch your arm to block it. But it came up tails the second time. If you interpret this as a binary number, what is that?
3.
Right? Tails gets you 3. So if you think about it as you flip the coin once to get the first bit, you flip the coin the second time to get the second bit, then you can just read off the number in binary and you should be good to go. You think there's something like gunk on the back or something? I'm only getting tails out of it.
Well, because those can look good against the heads, pass this out a little bit, so it's heavier to flip.
All right. If you flip it, see if you get a heads. Yeah, well, I gotta get a quarterback to him eventually. Yeah, I wasn't just paying you to get coins thrown at you. Tails. And there is a head on the other side, right? All right. Send it back. Everybody, put your helmets on.
I don't need any more data.
Sorry. Wobbly hands. All right, good. All right, so now we've got a way of taking just a coin. As long as we can flip it multiple times, we can randomly choose a number between 0 and 4. What about if we want to choose a number between 0 and 15? How can we generalize the ideas that we were just thinking about to handling a much wider range of possibilities? What's 15 in binary, by the way? Something like that will be on the test. There's a 1's place, a 2's place, a 4's place, an 8's place, 16th place, 0, 1, 8, 1, 4, that's 12, 1, 2, that's 14, 1, 1, that's 15. So it's 1, 1, 1, 1. So we're trying to pick a random number from 0, 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1, 1. How many coin flips can we do this in? Right? We flip a coin for the first bit, we flip a coin for the second bit, we flip a coin for the third bit, we flip a coin for the fourth bit. And read it off as a binary number, you get something that's between 0 and 15. And all those numbers are equally likely. Okay? So this bullet about how about 0 to 15, that's really easy too. In fact, 0 to any power of 2 minus 1, right? So 0 to 31, 0 to 63, 0 to 127. Those are all easy because you just have to choose each of the bits uniformly at random. Okay? And in fact, if you think about like a really big number, 65,535, say, you don't have to flip the coin that many times. All you have to flip it is log of that. So in that case, you need 16 coin flips to get 65,535. 0 to that. All right. All right, so I'm hoping that you get to all the powers of 2 now, because I want to throw in another trick. All right? If you get that, I want you to think about the next one. What about 0 to 2? All right? So now we're in a position where we want to choose... Oh. All right, I'll just... The world throws these challenges at me nonstop. All right. Ha! All right, so now we've got 3 choices, 0, 1, and 2. And we want to be able to somehow use the coin to choose equally among these 3 possibilities. All right, so the natural thing to do, what would be an easy thing to do that might not work? How many times can we flip the coin once and get a choice between these 3? How many different numbers can we distinguish with 1 coin flip?
2.
Right. So we've got 3 numbers. We're going to have to flip the coin at least twice. So what would the natural thing to do there? Well, we can flip the coin once, and we can build this sort of tree thing again. So we've got coin, heads, tails, coin, heads, tails, coin, heads, tails. All right, so we can flip the coin twice. On each of these paths, we flip it twice, and we get 4 possible outcomes. Maybe we could label them, I don't know, 0, 1, 2, 0 again? So now we've chosen randomly among those 3 choices. Any problems with that? There's a problem with that. It's not even in the sense that what? 0 is twice as likely. Right, so it's much more likely to come up 0 because 2 out of the 4 paths are 0. And only 1 out of the 4 are 1, and 1 out of the 4 are 2. So zeros are too likely. We have to make them somehow less likely. We could do that by, say, taking the 0 away and substituting it with a 1. Now the zeros are just the right amount of likely. Now the 1's are too likely. We have half probability of 1, half... okay. I can't believe I got this on the last try. We'll just make it 2. No, that's not going to work either. So, it's... Okay, what if we do... what if we don't flip this coin a second time? What if we go up to here and just put a 2 here? There we go. So now there's 1, 0, 1, 1, and 1, 2. Is that better? Why is that not better? Twos are still, half the time it's coming up twos. What's a coin to do? So how are we going to fix this? Any great ideas? Any bad ideas that would at least maybe get other people thinking?
Flip it 4 times?
We flip the coin 4 times?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
What do I do with that? Okay. All right.
Bad idea. Yes.
Flipping it. No. Flipping it. Well, flipping it more. So flipping it more times could help. Certainly, flipping it fewer isn't going to help. So that's worth thinking about. Yeah.
Just like call the second tails like X or something, and if it comes up tails twice, start over again. Or?
Oh. All right. Let me write this, and let's see what happens. So now the thought is we flip. All right, so if only we could have nothing here, we'd be done, right? We'd have 1/3 0, 1/3 1, 1/3 2. They'd be equally likely. If only somehow the universe just wouldn't do that. But it might. With probability 1/4, it will actually end up in this box. So here's the thought.
What was your name?
Dan.
Here's Dan's thought. Dan's thought is, at that point, instead of keeping it as a tree, we'll just go back to the top and start all over again. So basically, we'll call this a, what's it, mulligan, is that the word? It's like a do-over. Like, oh, that didn't work, let's try again. If this procedure stops, so there's two things that we have to figure out now. Will this stop? Or will it run forever? Let's try it. Because if it runs forever, we'll know, because then forever will come. All right, so, tails. Tails, so we're here. So we flip again. Oh, crap. It might actually work. Heads! 2. Ha. Alright, so this procedure can stop on 0, 1, or 2. Which of these is more likely than the others? They're all equally likely. 2 is not more likely than the others. The only way to get a 2 is if a particular series of coins come up. Tails, heads. Heads, tails, heads, heads. These are all equally likely. There's, with some probability, we have to go and start all over again. So if it stops, it's equally likely to stop on all of them. So now the next question is, will it always stop? Well, in principle, I could get an infinitely long sequence of tails. All right. What is the probability of an infinitely long sequence of tails? No, infinitely long. So I have to flip tails from now until never stopping.
50%?
It's not 50%. So one tail is 50%, but now another tail. So I'm going to start flipping now, and I'm going to stop when I get a head. I'm done. So what's the likelihood that I would run forever? This is kind of weird, because there's always some for any length of tails, there's some probability that will happen. But that probability falls off exponentially. And in fact, the probability that that an infinitely long sequence will come up all tails is zero. It can't happen. Or at least it can happen only with probability zero. Measure theory gets really funky when you're talking about infinite things. But the point is that for all practical purposes, this will end, and it'll actually end relatively soon. Yeah?
I'll get it.
Which part? Well, when I said measure theory, don't pretend that I didn't say that, because that was not helpful.
I was like, you're saying infinitely long probability of getting tails is very unlikely,
but it's
likely.
So what's the probability that if I start flipping this coin, and I only stop when I hit tails. I only stop when I hit heads. What's the probability that I'll never ever stop? And the answer is zero. There's always some probability that I will stop. And if you add up all the probabilities of all the different lengths, it adds up to one. There's nothing left for the infinite run of all tails. It's infinitely unlikely. It's zero. And that's maybe mind bending, but if you look at if you actually think about doing this, it will happen. We will get times when we have to go around and around and around, but each time there's some probability that it'll stop, and the probability that it'll go on forever, it just can't. Eventually we're going to pick 0, 1, or 2, and we'll pick them all with exactly equal probability. So it was good thinking outside the box. So instead of just flipping the coins and being done, we have this procedure that's going to run for some amount of time and eventually terminate with 0, 1, or 2 with equal probability. So very powerful little coin. Thank you for let me experience its power. All right. Now we can try this in scratch. Oh, did I do that? Well, this is what they would look like. Oh, this is zero. Yes. Okay. So here's a little scratch program for you picking a random bit at the top. Oh, see now you have to tell me whenever there's a symbol in scratch that you can't see because it's blurry. You have to tell me.
Because I keep thinking that it's legible. Is there anything you can't see there? Let's look at them one at a time. So we've got... RAM bit is in the upper left. It sets bit to either 0 or 1. Some probability, equal probability. To make a random number out of four choices, it calls RAM bit, stores the answer in bit 1. It calls RAM bit again, stores the answer in bit 2, and then sets the answer to 2 times bit 2 plus bit 1. And that takes those two bits and turns them into the four choices. 16 is the same idea. We flip the coin 4 times, we store bit 1, 2, 3, and 4, and we get the answer by taking 8 times the first bit, plus 4 times the next one, plus 2 times the next one, plus the last one. And to get the choices between 0 and 3, we have an actual loop. And here's what the loop says. It says, repeat until we get an answer, 0, 1, or 2. Set the first bit randomly. Set the second bit randomly. Oh, that's broken. This needs to be copied in. And then set the answer to 2 times the second bit plus the first bit. If the answer is 3, it'll try again. So this repeat loop will actually accomplish this step of the do-over. All right. So we can generate, just being able to make bits, we can generate kind of any random thing that we want. How do you use computers to generate random numbers? Computers do generate random numbers. They do not have a coin attachment stuck to them, where they flip a coin and look to see if it's heads or tails. And if they did, it's not even clear that that would be particularly random. How do computers generate random numbers when they themselves are deterministic devices, more or less? Oh, yes, you have an answer. Right, so one thing that they can do is take something that's changing all the time. Sometimes they have a little temperature sensor that's actually measuring the chip itself, and it uses some piece of that to be a source of randomness. It could be the time. The time it's counting time in like milliseconds, so it's every thousandth of a second, a clock is increasing. So if you took all the bits of the time and you sort of munch them around, you get something that looks kind of random. There's other things you can do as well. You can actually have deterministic sequences that cannot be distinguished from random sequences because they're too complicated. So there's an algorithm called the Mersenne Twister algorithm by these two guys from, I'm going to say, Japan in 97, that generates a sequence that's not random. It actually is a repeating sequence, but it only repeats every 2 to the, like, 20,000 steps. So you'll never, ever see this pattern repeat. And in fact, they've proven that the numbers that come out of it are equally distributed in 623 dimensions. So you get 32-bit random numbers that appear to all observers as being completely random. And it's also really, really fast, so you can generate these numbers very quickly. Python, when I use Python, I actually call this algorithm and it generates random numbers for me. So that's really helpful. So now we're up to what would be next time. All right, we're gonna play a little bit with that more next time, but let me spend a minute or two. Let me tell you these formulas because we're gonna come back to them, and the sooner you hear about them, the more likely they are to stick. So, how many times might we have to do a do over here on average? Sometimes we get it on the first try, like when I flipped the coin twice and I got the number 2 coming out. We had no do overs, but it could have very easily been the case that we did 1 do over. In fact, it could even be, it's less likely, but we could do 2 do-overs or 3. On average, how many do-overs do we have to do to get an answer out of this procedure? That's a useful question to be able to answer if you want to figure out how long a computation is going to take to run. So here's the interesting thing. It ends up being really, really simple. So let me start with an even simpler one. Let's say we're going to have me and you together. We're going to try to no, that's not a good example. Never mind. Me and my spouse, say, are going to try to make a girl. All right? And we're just going to keep having babies 50-50 until we get a girl. Question is, how big is our family going to be on average if everyone tried to do this, how big would families be? So it's the same question as I'm going to flip the coin until I get heads. How many times on average will I flip it? So what's the probability on any one of the trials that it will come up heads? It's a half, 50-50. So this rule says if the event has a probability p, then 1 over p tries on average before it happens. Okay. So if we have something that's probability a half, all right. So it's
Yes, it happens with probability half. How many times do we have to try it before it actually happens? It's probably half of having a girl, probably half of having the coin come up tails. Then the average is going to be 1 over p, which is what? What's, if p is a half, what's 1 over p? What's the reciprocal? 2, right? So 2 tries on average. Where does that come from? Well, what's the probability, this will go back to tails, what's the probability we get tails on the first try? Not probably 1. 1/2. All right, so we'll flip the coin once, half the time. We'll flip the coin twice, how often? Well, we'll have to get heads on the first time, tails on the second time. What's the probability of that? It's a quarter. We'll have to flip it 3 times if we get heads, heads, tails. The probability of that is 1/8. So we've got this infinite sum where we're adding together the number of flips it took and the likelihood that we needed that many flips. The number of flips it took and the likelihood that we need that many flips. That gives us the average. We're weighting it by the probability. If you work this all the way through, you get 2. I could do the algebra on that. Does anybody want to see that? Sure, what a great idea. Let's see if we can do that. I don't know. I haven't practiced this one. So the general form of this is we've got the sum. No, I don't know if I want to do this. The expected number of tries, we have to do it once, and then with probability 1 minus p, we may have to do it again from scratch. That should work. So what's x? X is the expected number of times we have to try this. We have to try it at least once, and then there's some probability that that was all we needed, probability p, and some probability that we need to do it more, 1 minus p. If that probability comes up, we're basically stuck starting from scratch. So the number of times that'll happen is x. We solve for this. We solve for x. It's x minus 1 minus p times x equals 1. Factor out the x. X 1 minus 1 minus p equals 1. Simplify. You get x. 1 minus 1 is 0 minus p. This is x times p equals 1, or x equals 1 over p. Oh, scary doing math without a net. But anyway, the point is that if the probability of the event is a half, the average number of times before it's going to happen is going to be 2, 1 over p. So what about in this case? What's the probability that we're going to get one of the good answers? Right? So there's 4 possible outcomes, 0, 1, 2, or do over. What's the probability that we get something other than do over? 75%, 3/4. So therefore, on average, how many times do we have to repeat this process before we get one of the good numbers? This is p. The probability of success is 3/4. Therefore, the expected number of tries is going to be 1 over p, which is 4/3, or 1 and a third. So on average, it's just a little bit more than 1 try. So this is, you know, this isn't going to take very long. It's not going to take 1 million tries. On average, it's going to take 1 1/3 tries. Okay? The baby example is the same as this one. Depending on what the probability, it's always just 1 over p. So we're going to look at various cases where this comes up shortly. The other two on the screen at the moment, if there's n distinct events that are equally likely. Oh, I see. All right, so I'm thinking of a number between 1 and n. What's the probability that you'll guess it on the first try? Assuming that you're guessing completely at random, uniformly at random. Not 0. No, if I've got 100 numbers that I'm thinking of, you might get it on the first try. What's the probability of that? 1 over 100, 1 over n in general. So if I've got n things, just choosing one of them and being right, if one of them that's randomly selected, is 1 over n. But there's other things that are interesting too, like if there's n different things that can happen and they're all equally likely. So I've got a deck of cards or something like that, or a twister. Let's say I've got a twister board, okay? And so I'm going to spin and I get some color, and then I'm going to spin again and I'm going to get some other color. I'm going to spin again. How long is it going to take before I've seen all the different colors? If there's n different colors, and the answer turns out to be n times the logarithm of n, the natural log of n, mostly on average. So on the other hand, if we wanted them to come out in a particular order, so we have to wait for green, and once we get green, then we're going to wait for blue, and once we get blue, we're going to wait for, well, what's the problem? How long are we going to have to wait? Actually, we can do this one, right? How long do we have to wait to see green for the first time? If there's n different colors, and we're going to keep spinning until we get one particular color that we want. On average, how many spins is that going to require? Right, so what's the probability of getting green on any spin if there's n different colors? Good night. All right, so if we've got n colors, the probability of some specific color like green is what? We spin the spinner, it can come up to any of those n colors, equally likely. What's the chance that it's the one that we want? 1 over n, right, right. And so how many spins on average before we get green? If this is our probability of the event we want, it's the reciprocal of that, it's n. So there's n different colors. If we want one particular color, we may have to wait on average n spins to see it. If we want to see that color, and then we want to see the next color, and we want to see the next color, it's n, and then another n, and another n, n times n, or n squared. So that's what it says there. If we're waiting for them to come out in some particular order, then it's n squared. If we start with the number n and we cut it in half, oh, you have to cut it in half log n times before 1 is reached. So we're going to put these facts together in various kinds of analyses later, but I wanted to just, you know, present them in their vanilla form first so you had a chance to see it. All right, with that being said, I think we're good to go. Any other questions or anything before we stop? Yeah, it's too late at that point. Eventually, I'll figure out how to do this. Thank you, everybody.